Okay, so I will try to describe what can we learn about massive formation from gamma ray bursts, and to stress also some controversies about this issue. So gamma ray bursts are gamma ray sources, highly variable, brief. The duration is about 10 seconds. They are divided into two classes. I will show this in a minute. And they outshine at maximum the gamma ray sky, but they are highly transient. They fade away extremely rapidly. As I said, they, according to duration, they are divided. The distribution of the BATSI instrument, which has been so far the most accurate and sensitive gamma ray instrument for the study of gamma ray bursts, it has detected about 3,000 gamma ray bursts in its almost 10 years lifetime. The BATSI result is that, according to duration, gamma ray bursts are divided, are bimodal, have a bimodal distribution, are divided into two subclasses. The majority are the so-called long gamma ray bursts, and I will concentrate on long mostly during this talk. And then there are the sub-second gamma ray bursts. This subdivision is actually mirrored in the spectrum. The short gamma ray bursts have a marginally harder spectrum than long ones. And the common belief, the common consensus nowadays is that long gamma ray bursts, virtually all long gamma ray bursts come from supernovae, from core collapse, type 1c supernovae, while short gamma ray bursts come from the mergers of neutron stars. And maybe we can talk about short gamma ray bursts some other time.
What is T90?
T90 is the usual way of defining, the BATSI team has devised to define the duration. It's the time it takes for a gamma ray burst to get from 5% of its total fluence to 95% of its total fluence. It's a way to avoid biases, because it's difficult to define the duration. At some point, it gets out of the background, and then it subsides to background. So how do you define in the most objective way the duration? And this is one method used by the BATSI team. These are the afterglows. The gamma ray burst itself is very bright, extremely elusive, extremely rapid, but it leaves a remnant at lower energies, at X-ray energies. This is the first, this is a historical slide. It's the first detection of X-ray and optical afterglow from a gamma ray burst 10 years ago, 97-0228. So there is a, at the position of the gamma ray burst, there is an X-ray leftover, an X-ray aftermath, and in the optical there is one is left, which is seen, by the way, up to 6 months after, but with HST. Only with HST you can do these things. You can see these optical, very dim sources. The afterglow is here, is the bright pixel at the outskirts of this nebulosity, which is the host galaxy. We'll talk more about this in a more quantitative way. This is generally the behavior of afterglows, both in X-rays and optical. They fade away. They are very bright at the beginning. Then they fade away with time fairly quickly. T to the minus 1.3 is the typical decay law. So the name of the game here is rapidity. I mean, you have to go on top of the position of the gamma ray burst very quickly to spot the remnant, the afterglow, and follow its decay.
Andy, could you move your computer a little toward me?
Yes.
It's blocking the corner.
Oh, sorry.
Just toward me. Perfect. There you go. I think that'll
be okay. So these are the once you have an optical afterglow, an optical remnant, you can take spectra of these sources, and this is a typical spectrum of a of an optical afterglow taken few days after. Oh, thanks. Taken few days after the explosion. And this is typically what you see. The red shifts are typically one, even much lower and much larger. I will show a distribution. But at redshift one, typically these are the species you observe. So you observe both absorption spectra, iron lines and magnesium lines, which are often used to derive metallicities. in absorption. So this is when the source is still bright, when you still have a bright afterglow. You have high contrast and you can get very good absorption spectrum. But you have also emission lines from the host galaxy, not from the afterglow, from the host galaxy, and those are permanent. Those you can observe even years after the afterglow has faded. In fact, this is a pure host galaxy spectral study. You can observe, again, these redshifts, typically the Balmer series, and the almost ubiquitous oxygen line. This you observe at redshift 1 very well with the CCDs, and this is the most popular star formation indicator in gamma ray bursts, oxygen 2, 3727. I would like to draw your attention to this line, neon 3, which is not ubiquitous. It's not observed often, but this is just for observational limitations. It is observed, and it indicates extreme conditions of temperature, high ionization conditions. So this already gives you an idea of the ambient, of the close environment of the gamma ray burst. It's rich of early type stars. So this is the distribution of the...
Perhaps, right? I mean, principally it could be completely unrelated.
I will show something about this. Yes, yes, there's something interesting about this, something curious.
More than a few guys, yeah.
Yes, yeah. In a minute I will show it. This is the redshift distribution. It's, in fact, the total energy emitted in the prompt event, in the gamma ray burst proper, in the gamma ray event, computed in isotropic condition, assuming the gamma ray burst is a 4 pi, is a spherical emitter. In fact, we now know, we suspect that there is a good reason to believe it's not an isotropic emitter. Gamma ray bursts have jets. And so this is an isotropic assumption versus redshift. These are almost, well, a good fraction of the gamma ray bursts with redshift measurement so far. And you see the subdivision, the green ones are the majority, the long ones. It's more difficult to find redshifts for short gamma ray bursts because they have dimmer optical counterparts. The red ones are the shorts. And the four blue dots, the four blue circles are the four gamma ray bursts with spectroscopic identification of a supernova, of an underlying supernova. As you see, they are all at low redshift, obviously, because at high redshift, the supernova light, if there is a supernova, as we suspect, as I said, virtually all long gamma ray bursts have supernovae, but if there is one underlying the afterglow, presumably at high redshift, it's outshone by the optical light from the afterglow. So in these low redshift cases, you have a selection effect. You are favored by a bias, by a selection effect. At low redshift, you can see a gamma ray burst and an optical afterglow, even if it's dim. However, in those cases, then you see, well, the supernova. And this is the first very famous case of supernova 98BW associated with the 980425, the first case of clear association between gamma ray bursts and supernova. The redshift, indeed, is very low. This is 35 megaparsecs, approximately. And the supernova, characteristic of the supernova is it is a type 1C, as every other supernova detected underlying a gamma ray burst. So it's a core collapse supernova in which no hydrogen and no helium lines are detected. The spectra have no hydrogen and helium features, meaning that the exploding star has lost all of its hydrogen and helium envelopes. The supernova was very bright, was very luminous. It had very broad light curves, but that's not the distinctive feature. The distinctive feature is the spectrum. The supernova 98BW is extremely more energetic than supernovae, than type 1C supernovae. This is a comparison of 98BW with a 1C and a 1B supernova, normal 1C and 1B supernovae. The spectrum is similar in the three cases, but the 98BW absorption features are much broader than the same features in the two normal supernovae, in the two previous supernovae. These two supernovae are not known to be associated with any gamma ray burst. So the idea is there is evidence that a supernova associated with a gamma ray burst is just is clearly classifiable as a type 1c, but the velocities are much higher than in normal type 1c supernovae. And therefore, the kinetic energies are much higher. Indeed, 98BW has a kinetic energy of 10 to the 52 erg, which is at least an order of magnitude higher than seen in type 1c supernovae.
Could any of this be an orientation effect?
That
it's just that, you know, in the case where there's a GRB, you're looking down the pole of the outflow, and so...
There is an indication. We may. It's a separate talk. It would be a separate issue, but there is clear indication that supernovae associated with gamma ray bursts, even core collapse supernovae not associated with gamma ray bursts, are asymmetric, do have asymmetries, but they are not as dramatic as necessary to justify an order of magnitude difference. This is certainly. Gamma ray bursts are extremely asymmetric sources. They can be, their luminosities can be amplified by factors of 1,000, 10,000, relativistically. In supernovae, we know there are these asphericities. They certainly modify the energy you measure from a supernova, depending on whether you look at it down the axis of symmetry or perpendicularly. But the difference is a factor of 2, let's say. Not a factor of 10. And this is a summary of what we know of supernovae 1c. The top ones, the top four ones, are the light curves of type 1c supernovae associated with the four GRBs, the four blue circles I've shown at the beginning. These are the four supernovae. The dimmer, these three dimmer supernovae are normal supernovae, meaning they don't have a gamma ray burst associated. However, 97EF and O2AP are type 1c supernovae with significant, with remarkable kinetic energy, not as high as the GRB supernovae. And then there is 94I, which is a prototypical type 1c supernova, well studied. It has a very well sampled light curve, and it's a completely normal supernova, normal kinetic energy, normal spectrum. So there is a continuum of properties, evidently, and but clearly GRB supernovae are the most luminous ones and the most energetic ones. So host galaxies, getting closer to the environments of GRB formation. This is I've already shown this figure. This is the host of the first GRB for which an afterglow has been detected, 970228. From this first host galaxy, we learned about the typical appearance of GRB hosts. The majority of them are like this. They are small, faint, blue, and irregular. This is not... This host cannot be associated clearly with any type, with clear type of galaxies. It's a nebulosity, irregular morphology, irregular nebulosity. This is instead one of the very few cases in which you can type the host very precisely. It's a grand design spiral. It's at redshift 0.8, so you do expect that at this redshift, these spirals are already formed. The gamma ray burst, as is typical, is located on the stellar field of the galaxy, but not in the center. This is a typical situation for gamma ray bursts. They are, their locations coincide with the stellar field. They are never found isolated, far from galaxies, isolated but at some distance from host galaxies. They are always on top of their hosts, but never in the center. Always with some, there is always a projected distance of few arc seconds, which corresponds to these redshifts to 10, 20, 30 kiloparsecs, projected distance.
So are there some long-duration bursts where they don't see the supernovae? I mean, there are, right?
Yes, of course, yeah. Most
are they spatially different in terms of...
This one is at redshift 0.8. So any supernova underlying this would be, this has a very bright optical afterglow. So any supernova like 98BW underlying this one would have been undetected. It would be outshone by the afterglow, by the optical afterglow. So, and this is a typical situation. Most of the redshift higher than 0.3 gamma ray bursts do not show a supernova. At most, they show a bump in the light curve. Small bump in the light curve.
They still avoid the nucleus.
Yes.
It's hard to see the supernova.
Yes. Usually they are They are usually at some non-zero distance, some significant distance. HST can clearly resolve them with respect to the.
Those are the long bursts that don't show supernova.
That's right. Yeah.
But do show afterglows.
Do show afterglows.
So what fraction of the long bursts show afterglows?
It's a bit of a long story because it's full of biases, full of observational limitations. Nowadays, with Swift, the average redshift of Swift GRBs is rather high. It's like between 1 and 1.5. And therefore, you have, presumably, in most of the cases, you have a lot of absorption, or the optical afterglows are dim. As a result, 50-60% of Swift GRBs have an optical, unobserved, a detected optical afterglow. This is another typical situation for a host galaxy. This is redshift 1.6, where you don't expect many formed galaxies to exist. So you expect this situation. This is an irregular. It's an ensemble of interacting objects. And the bright optical afterglow is here, at the outskirts of this merging situation. And here is an even more extreme situation of merging, an irregular morphology. And finally, this is an example of how frustrating the host galaxy search can be. This is the host galaxy of the gamma ray burst, this smudge here, this tiny thing. This is one of the intrinsically faintest and intrinsically less luminous hosts ever detected. Obviously, this is all of these are HST detections. The magnitude is 28.5. It's extremely faint.
How do you know that blob is the one? How do you know there's an association between that blob and the GRB?
Well, it's the host. This is an image of the host. The position of the gamma ray burst was exactly on top of this.
Oh, okay. That's not okay. So right,
yes.
The
afterglow is gone here. The afterglow is gone. This is a late time image, taken months later, and the afterglow was. The astrometry shows that.
I thought the afterglow was the bright dot in the center.
No. In fact, okay. in this case, you have clearly no way of measuring any offset. Between the offset was consistent with zero, and that's a very small, extremely small for this redshift, extremely small galaxy. The typical property of these hosts is that they are extremely blue, so they are small, generally small, faint, irregular, strange morphologies, and they are blue. This is a comparison of their V-H color of five of them, an example of a subsample of five of them, with the V-H color of many other classes of sources within the Hubble Deep Field survey. And the five GRB hosts are as blue or bluer than any other kind of object. Here you have galaxies and also stars. So they are among the bluest objects. However, a blue color would suggest you a high star formation, very high star formation. However, it's been a bit of a surprise to learn from Spitzer that these objects do not emit very much in the far infrared. Spitzer detects only 20% of a sample of well-studied host galaxies. And so there are no, the clearly these objects are star forming, but they are not starbursts. They don't have dramatic star formation. The star formation rates, indeed, there were claims based on millimetric radian millimetric observations that the star formation rates were as high as 100 or 1,000 solar masses per year, and those turned out to be misidentifications. I mean, overlap in the same field, there was significant contamination from nearby millimetric sources. Spitzer has proven this. There's no far infrared emission from these objects, not significant. Star formation rates, in fact, are high, but reasonable, not extremely high, 1/10 solar masses per year. However, since these are extremely small galaxies, if you weigh the star formation rate by the mass, with the mass of the galaxy, you get extremely high specific star formation rates. The star formation rates are the specific star formation rates. Star formation rates per mass, per unit mass, are very high.
What luminosity is there? What bolometric luminosity is typical? I mean, you say 100 meters.
The bolometric luminosity is like sub L star. These objects are 1/10 of the Milky Way. Are like, they are very similar to the between the small and large Magellanic Cloud. The luminosity is very typical.
But the star formation rate is like M82, which is a kind of a large dwarf galaxy, but pretty serious starburst.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, the integrated star formation rate is like this, normal. But then if you compute by per unit mass, then those are very high. And obviously, one problem here is the extinction. You have to be sure that you have de-extinguished your star formation rate in the correct way. That's a general problem, right? I mean, it's not just a problem with GRB. With GRBs.
But is there a potential bias here in that you only find the host if you can find the afterglow? And the afterglow, I can imagine if you set off a GRB in something that was very, had a really high star formation rate but was very big and dusty, something like ARC-220, you would never find the afterglow.
Actually, this has been afterglow in radio.
In radio, that's right. This was thought to be one bias, right. But then you see many afterglows, many GRBs which are optical dark. You don't see the optical afterglow, but you see the afterglow. The radio is not blocked.
Sure. Okay.
And nowadays, with these XRT or Chandra, very accurate positions, okay, you get also very precise X-ray positions, so that you can identify a galaxy in the Chandra boxes, for example. You can just find one galaxy.
Okay.
You are fairly sure that galaxy is a host. Yeah, this is a farther typical. This is the host of one of the GRB supernovae. The redshift is very low, 0.033. This is the host of supernova 2006 AJ, associated with the X-ray flash of 18 February 2006. And this is a small Magellanic Cloud. It's extremely similar. And here is the clearly there must be an association. The properties of the host galaxies suggest a very strict, very tight association with massive stars. But we have a little problem here, as Tom was recalling before. This is the lowest redshift GRB, as I mentioned, the one associated with the supernova 98BW. It's very close by, so one can study the environment very precisely. This is a ground-based image, and these are blow-ups of the of sub-regions, of these two regions of the host. There is one region here, and this region here. This small region here is the supernova region. The supernova went off here. However, if you look at this region is an oxygen too rich region, but not too. There is some oxygen, but not too much. The really astonishing thing is this region here. this region, if you take a spectrum of this object, you find evidence of a couple of thousand of O stars and several hundreds, about 100 Wolf-Rayet stars. And the spectral feature, the indication of the presence of these very hot objects is this bump here. Here is a blow-up, you see, several species. This is considered to be a signature of the presence of a lot of Wolf-Rayet and hot stars. So this object here is clearly a nursery of very hot objects, of very hot stars. But it is at least 500 parsecs from the position of the supernova. So there's something, in fact, the estimate of an accurate computation says that this is 800 parsecs. Anyway, the object, the GRB has exploded in a region which is very far, physically very far from the star formation region. So nobody knows what happened here. If the progenitor of the gamma ray burst has been born here and has exploded here, clearly it's a runaway star. It's a runaway massive star.
That requires a huge velocity. It's 800 parsecs, yeah, 4 million years.
Yeah, right.
That's 200 kilometers a second. Even
at 100 kilometers per second during the lifetime, like 10 or 50, like 50 mega years.
Well, wait, what kind of mass are you talking about for the progenitor? For type 1Cs, aren't they very massive?
That's the whole problem we are talking about here.
Million years, not 10 million years. It's only
four. Yeah. Yeah, that's the whole.
It looks like
200 kilometers a second is too fast. Or faster than the escape velocity.
Or it's a smaller star. Or it is a smaller star. So after all, GRB progenitors are massive, but cannot be too massive, big.
Don't they know what the progenitors are for type 1 Cs? The very massive stars are the ones that lose their envelopes.
They're like 30. You need at least 30 solar masses. At least 30 solar masses.
30 solar mass stars don't live, 50 million years. Yeah.
Okay, so we have a problem here.
Also, it's right in the middle of a bunch of other, as you point out, it's not as rich a star-forming region, but it's right in the middle of a star-forming region. It'd be kind of accidental that it happened to blow up just when it was in the middle of.
Was that what those are? I mean, all those other, can you identify what those other?
This is the remnant. This is
right,
the supernova
the
remnant.
This
is the supernova remnant.
Right, but what is the other stuff around it?
I don't know what they are. They may be stars. There are stars here. It's just a more modest, it's an oxygen 2 region. It's just not the brightest and most luminous oxygen 2 region that you can detect.
I would say that it's unlikely if you shoot it out that it happens to blow up just when it gets to another star formation region.
What I can say is that there are some cases, at least one case, 0209-03, it's another case of this kind, a close by low redshift case, in which it seems the same thing seems to have happened. The gamma ray burst position is far away, is at significant distance, same order of magnitude, like 500 parsecs, from a superstar cluster, from a region of high star formation. And the signal-to-noise, the signal-to-noise is not as good as here, because this is at redshift 0.25, not 36 megaparsecs. But there seems to be the same situation.
Do you have the spectra of many of the other blobs in the galaxy?
No, this is the spectrum, and this is the slit. This is the position of the slit.
The separation of giant H2 regions and, say, Argyr's far galaxy is of order a kiloparsec. They're separate regions that are forming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's about the scale of separation you have between one and the other.
Yeah. Maybe by chance, yeah. I don't know, but...
It could be that...
Well, that's in situ.
What's the relative star formation rate between those two clumps?
Oh, it's...
100?
It's... The metal, I know that the metallicity is very, is a bit lower here, is like 0.3 here, and here is 0.5, so it's similar. The star formation rate in the region of the supernova is small, is less than one solar mass per year, and certainly higher in the superstar cluster, much higher in the superstar cluster, in this region here.
What's the metallicity in that region?
Here it's like it's estimated to be like 0.5 solar, and here it is estimated like 1/3 solar.
One-third.
Here, they are similar. So this is a, obviously it doesn't this fact doesn't compromise very much the association between GRBs. And star formation, and massive star formation. But it suggests that the relationship may be not as direct as we were thinking. Because obviously this, if a star runs away from the superstar cluster and ends its life somewhere else, this situation, this escape, may influence it dynamically, may have an influence on its stripping. It must. We shouldn't forget that these stars must lose their hydrogen and their helium. So this escape may influence the loss of angular momentum and the stripping of the star.
Well, that actually seems like potentially another problem, because as I understand it, you want to have a companion so that you can dump your atmosphere onto.
Yeah.
And I have no idea how you could possibly eject it that fast and keep the companion.
Eject a binary that fast and keep...
Well, yeah, the point is, I mean, anything, you know, 200 kilometers a second or 100 kilometers a second is vastly larger than the orbital velocity of any plausible binary that you're going to make. And so whatever if you had a process that were capable of kicking the star out that fast, it would leave its companion behind.
That's also a problem, yeah. And yeah, so here is a summary of the situation of host galaxies, of gamma ray bursts. This is from a work with Fruchter. These are the gamma ray burst hosts of many, if not all, gamma ray bursts observed with HST by that time, by the time of the paper. And so you see these, the very different morphologies. And we compared it with a sample of similar size and similar redshift distribution of core collapse supernovae. The aim of this work was, the motivation was that gamma ray bursts are produced by core collapse explosions. They must come from similar environments. They must have similar parent hosts. And so we've compared the gamma ray burst GRB hosts with the core collapse hosts. But even at first glance, even when you look at this slide, even without quantitative argument or consideration, you immediately note that the morphologies of the core collapse supernovae are much more regular than the morphologies of the GRB hosts. And this is already a problem. This is the first problem. And in a bit more quantitative way, we can say that the blue points, the blue indicates in this view graph the GRBs, and the red indicates the supernovae. You see here the distribution of absolute magnitude of these hosts versus the radius, which contains 80% of the light. And here are the projections. Here are two histograms, the projections of these populations in a magnitude histogram and a radius histogram. And you can see that gamma ray bursts are both fainter and smaller than supernovae hosts. Here on the right is an experiment Fruchter carried out on these data. He said if supernovae trace the light, core collapse supernovae trace the massive star light in their hosts, then GRBs should do the same, because GRBs are supernovae, come from supernovae. So what he did, he ordered all of the pixels in the image of a host from faintest to brightest, and he asked the question, what fraction of the light of the host is contained in the pixels, in all pixels, fainter or equal to the pixel where the GRB is, or where the supernova is. And while with supernovae, he gets a result which is conformal with the expected result. I mean, with this experiment, you should observe, if you do an unbiased experiment, you should get a result which is uniformly distributed between 0 and 1. And for supernovae, it is distributed between 0 and 1 uniformly. While for GRBs, there is clearly a bias toward larger, higher light, toward a brighter light. Namely, GRBs are preferentially located in the very brightest pixels of their host galaxies, much more than supernovae do. So GRBs are much more dramatic tracers of bright light than supernovae.
Except they're not in the center. I thought most galaxies, the brightest pixels are
that, that's right. But the point is that the supernovae, the hosts of GRBs are not regular. No. So they are. Here you see a typical example. In a regular galaxy, clearly the bright part is the bulge. But in the hosts of GRBs, here you see a very irregular host, very irregular shape. The brightest points are at the outskirts. This is the clearest example of this fact. Here is another one. You have bright spots of light in zones, in regions of the galaxy which are unrelated to the center. So there is a difference, after all. There is a clear separation, a clear difference between core collapse supernovae and GRB hosts. And what's the reason? We asked what this can come from. And one idea Fruchter has proposed is that the metallicity makes the difference. GRB hosts are less metallic than the supernova hosts. And this may, so low metallicity may favor the formation of whatever they are, progenitors of the gamma ray bursts. For example, the most massive stars, low metallicity may favor regions, may favor formation of these more massive progenitors for gamma ray bursts. There is a recent work by Mariam Mojas who compared the metallicities of the hosts. This is a very low redshift work. She compared the metallicities of the hosts of GRB supernovae, core collapse supernovae clearly associated with GRBs, and supernovae not associated. Supernovae 1C, or core collapse supernovae, 1C supernovae, in fact, not associated with GRBs. The blue ones, GRB supernovae in the bottom, and non-GRB supernovae on top. And there is a clear segregation, a clear separation according to metallicity. The GRB supernova hosts seem to be less metallic than the non-GRB supernova hosts. And the comparison sample is this yellow cloud here, which contains unrelated galaxies from the SDS, star-forming galaxies from the SDSS. So there seems to be a metallicity bias, a clear metallicity difference between GRB and supernova hosts. However, and here is the last controversy I would like to point out. There is an increasing number of GRBs, the hosts of which can be studied spectroscopically in a fairly accurate way. And it looks like the metallicities of GRB hosts are the diamonds here. Metallicities of the GRB hosts is higher, is systematically higher than the metallicity of most DLAs at comparable redshifts. At the point, here you have here, the dashed line here indicates a metallicity of 0.3 solar, which is the limit for the validity of the collapsar model for GRBs. Beyond this line, above this line, the collapsar model has problems. And most high redshift GRBs seem to be dangerously close to the limit, to the limiting line for the collapsar model. So unexpectedly, high redshift GRBs are hosted by much more metallic environments than DLAs at similar, comparable redshift ranges. So this is...
There are biases.
There may be biases. Yes, no, I'm not saying it is... I'm not saying the comparison between the diamonds and the DLAs is... The GRB hosts and the DLAs is tremendously significant, but I find this that this point is significant, that the vicinity of these points to the borderline, to the limiting line, is significant, is creating a problem.
But what about the metallicity of these versus the low redshift? Are they the same or are they higher in
the depth? That's about the trend. There is a range of metallicities in GRB host galaxies. There is a very wide range.
In your previous graph, the low MOJAS and all, that was fairly narrow range and was also low.
Yeah, but those are...
Yeah, but it wasn't that low. I mean, it was a tenth to a third, wasn't it?
But those are very low redshift. These are very low.
I don't know what the oxygen amount is anymore, so you can't put that on a metallicity block.
Well, but at least it was less than everybody else.
Right, but it's a third. When you look at it, I think with standard numbers, it's still a third to a tenth, isn't it? Everybody
yeah. does this. It even lower.
They're good ones, but what about 98 BW? That's a third, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which you could, well, as I say, we don't know what that.
Well, but it's still below the other size, whatever the
that's
scale.
That's right. That's quite right.
So I'm just asking, if you now look at the high redshift ones, are they also the lower metallicity than? Well, I'm sorry. Do they have the same metallicity as the red dots there, or are they higher metallicity?
They are about the same, like one third. So this is one third solar, and more or less that's the number. Yeah. So yeah, these are the points I wanted to make, and I will leave it. I will leave it here.
Okay.
So about the standard conclusion that it's type 1Cs, because you don't see any hydrogen and helium, but when you sort of look at some of the other lines are also highly broadened. So I'm curious about the actual physical upper limit of how much fraction of...
Which fraction of helium?
Hydrogen or helium, and you still don't see it.
Paolo must know this.
Hydrogen is very, very, very small, because you won't see it. Helium, it's probably half a solar mass in a ball ejector because of the lack of the infrared bands, which are very nicely isolated. And you would see those clearly.
And there's no issue with the modeling. I mean, you get everything fine for all the other lines. Because I'm just thinking, you know, there are all these clear exposure differences. Okay.
On the DLAs, I'm wondering, so Art Wolf has been pushing this idea that the DLA distribution is sort of bimodal, that there are some DLAs where you're looking through a star-forming part of an actual galaxy.
That's right.
And others where you're just looking through, you know, sort of the outer H1 envelope, like there is around the Milky Way, where nothing's really going on. So my question is, if you accept, say, his bimodality of the DLAs, and you were only to plot the star-forming, the DLAs that he says are, you know, you're looking through the star-forming part of the disks, how do you know how the metallicity distribution of the GRBs compares to the star-forming DLAs as opposed to all the DLAs?
It's rather heterogeneous. I mean, you are sampling different environments with DLAs and with GRB DLAs. They are not easily comparable because you are sampling different lines of sight and different environments, because a GRB DLA is its host. It's the host galaxy of the GRB.
Right. I guess what I was suggesting is a way to try and reduce that heterogeneity by throwing out of the sample the DLAs that you know your line of sight isn't going anywhere near anything star forming.
I don't know if you can do that. I don't think you can do that easily.
I think Mark's point is really good, actually, right? I mean, Art did this with excited Kerbin 2 fine structure lines. He measured cooling rates. So then, you know, he inferred heating rates in the galaxies, and where they're high, these are the ones that must actually be near star forming regions.
So you're suggesting that one should use only those?
Yes.
In this comparison.
Yeah,
then you'd be high.
We could do that, yeah.
I mean, these are at redshift 4, right? So if you just take the standard metallicity decrease found by Cooley and others, then you get, you know, you'll down, be down to a 30th or something of solar in your average galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's 0.1 dex per unit redshift. 0.15 dex per unit.
So you're saying at high redshift, actually, the GRB is now occurring in supermetal-rich galaxies?
No, no, they're
because you said it's down to a 30th in redshift 4, but she's up
0.15 dex, so redshift 4, so that's 4, that's 0.6, so 1/8.
What is solar? Okay, that's basically minus 1%.
And if the metallicity goes above 1/3 solar, you don't have gamma reverse anymore?
The point is that for a low metallicity, In one of the latest versions of the collapsar model, you can have, you can form GRBs even from single stars with by losing very small angular momentum, but you need a very small metallicity.
Wait.
You can keep high angular momentum, but then you need a metallicity less than 0.1 solar. So this line indicates the point where you start having problems with the collapsar. In the collapsar model, you have the problem that you have to have a stripped star, because you observe type 1c supernovae. So the star has to be stripped of hydrogen and helium. So the problem is, how do you strip your star without losing angular momentum? Because you need angular momentum to make the GRB. And this is a problem. It's virtually impossible, or it's very difficult to lose enough angular momentum for a GRB, to get type 1c by to go to the final, to the end point of a star which explodes as a type 1c, but keeping the angular momentum.
You need to lose the mass,
but not. So metallicity allows you to lose mass. But if you lose mass, you lose angular momentum. So the collapsar wants a low metallicity to avoid losing mass and to avoid losing angular momentum.
Well,
but then the star doesn't get stripped. That's the whole point.
Explains it, so I wrote that paper. Right, so what happens is you get this chemically homogeneous evolution that the Eddington sweep mixing time is rapid, so your star is chemically homogeneously mixed.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't, and because the metallicity is low, you lose very little mass.
Okay.
Star, but because it's mixed, then you get, you know, you burn it all, go to helium, the star becomes, you know, a wolf red, etc. And it's still rotating rapidly. But you haven't lost the angular momentum in the wind.
And you haven't lost the mass.
You haven't lost the mass, because, and that's the mass limit where you have to be down at a tenth or a third. Okay, it goes as z to the 0.6, so you prefer to be at a tenth. Right? But you don't lose the mass, you keep the rotation, and the rotation helps you mix the whole thing,
yeah.
And then you get the effective Wolf-Rayet type 1c,
yeah.
You know, the whole
thing.
It's a single star. Oh, it's quite high, you know, it's 50 or something.
Okay. But
so the idea is you didn't strip it the way you did.
I do not, yes, that's yes, what you, right. You cannot have a collapsar and strip it.
I see.
You'll lose so much angular momentum.
You destroy the hydrogen by burning it.
Yeah, and this was a beautiful idea of Adair and Manel about 10, 15 years ago.
So what about the helium?
What
about the helium?
You burned it all to helium. You make the Wolf-Rayet star because you've mixed it. The Eddington sweep mixing time.
But we don't have any helium either. So how do you get out of that?
Yeah.
I'm burning helium.
That's hard to do.
And actually, if you look closely, the carbon oxygen ratio is much smaller than in Wolf-Rayet stars.
Sorry.
The carbon to oxygen ratio is nowhere near 1. It's more like 0.1. So it's much more involved than any Wolf-Rayet star.
I'll have to look up the numbers.
The point.
I admit that in this paper I didn't do the nuclear synthesis.
No, the point is that you need a very low 1/10 solar metallicity.
To not lose the wind.
Yeah. You need, that model needs the metallicity to be rather low.
Well, the number we got, if you believe Langer et al., is a third. Exactly that line.
This line.
Perfect. Yeah. It fits the cosmic evolution.
Yeah.
It fits that line. The one trick is you have to have rapidly rotating stars.
Yeah, yes.
And that's harder to do.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is that we have, I mean, there are, all of these points are just at the border of that line.
Exactly right.
So there are other models than collapsars.
Well, my view, I actually like the view in which you have a binary. There is this is a rather old view. In fact, it's an 11. The first one who put this idea forward was Van Dyck. In 1996, he had a paper in which he said core collapse supernovae are basically the same objects, but type 1c come from binaries. The type 2 are single stars, and type 1c come from binaries. And I think this is what's happening here. You need, because a binary, clearly, the membership, the binary membership allows your GRB progenitors to keep its spin, its intrinsic spin. So you have, with a binary, you have a good way to strip the star by keeping angular momentum, regardless of metallicity.
So why would that?
The problem is then, why are the GRB and supernovae hosts different? That doesn't explain, the binarity doesn't explain, the binarity view doesn't explain that difference. But
the two populations that you seem to compare, the two pictures, right, the assembly of the assembly of pictures.
Yeah.
The one is just a small fraction of the number you have for the other, right? So have you done a KS test?
No, yes, no. These are just two pictures. The test has been done on samples of equal size. I think it's 16 objects per sample.
What is the probability?
No, it's high. It's significant. It is significant. It's a KS test gives a significant probability.
Just those two curves for the, you know, the pixel, right?
Yeah.
The KS statistic for that
it's significant.
Very significant.
Yes, it is.
So how would the binary mechanism be favored above metallicity?
No, it's independent. At that point, it's independent. The binarity doesn't. The metallicity issue is in this Fruchter et al. Context is a way out of the problem of the difference between the hosts. It's a hypo.
But Marion showed they are low metallicity. So yeah. why would that happen in a binary hypothesis? He said,
"I'm desperately to defend his theory."
Yeah.
So why?
Yeah.
Well, I'm asking the same question, but not out of self-interest. So.
Very good.
So answer his.
That's adjacent.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. This was at the level of dinner discussion. But there is a colleague, a Russian colleague, suggested that in a low metallicity, in these small low metallicity environments, you can favor the formation of binary systems, but dynamically. But
all the stars are binaries.
But, I mean, yeah.
Every one of these stars is going to be a binary. It's just a question of, is it going to be close enough to get its envelope stripped off?
As I say, this would need a quantitative, it has to do with the potential of the galaxy itself. It needs a quantity. I would like to do this more quantitatively because we discussed this in a more serious way.
Does the binary mechanism entail a particular mass ratio in addition to close separation?
I don't think it has been investigated. I don't know if Paolo has.
It's not really the numbers. It can
no.
be very large because we're going to start to go off.
Yeah.
So this must be the less massive star of the two. So I mean, if you start with one, it's four. The other one has to be more than that.
Yeah.
Okay. So Paolo, you had an objection that sounded serious. I mean, the C to O ratio was wrong.
The C to O ratio that we see is about 0.1. And I've been looking at Wolf Rayet literature and talking to people that, you know, do the analysis of Wolf Rayet atmospheres, which is not easy. And, you know, they usually, at the best, find very little helium, which is very rare, in the WCs, and a C over O of 1. And this is nothing like what we see. So obviously there's a phase we see.
Okay, maybe we should go ahead and thank Elena again. Thank you very much for that.
was
thank you.
I didn't realize.
Oops. Yeah, there are lots of problems. Yeah, there are more problems than data.
Email asking. That's good. Asking a question.